Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram weekend edition for Saturday, August 27th, 2022. Section A. County and Sheriff Reach Pay Deal by Stuart Doreen. On Friday, during a conversation with the Midland County Commissioner's Court, it became apparent Sheriff David Kreiner wasn't going to get the entire raises he was seeking for his patrolmen and jailers. That's when he said he wanted to reach common ground with county leaders, and that is exactly what happened. Jailers will receive a 15% increase, which is three grade levels in the county's salary structure. County Judge Terry Johnson's proposed budget called for a 28% raise, but commissioners at one point seemed to favor a two-grade increase. Common ground reached. Patrol deputies also will increase 15% against lower than the 22% Johnson had proposed, based on Kreiner's recommendation, but again more than a two-grade increase. Common ground reached. Also, jail corporals, investigators, and patrol corporals received 15% raises. Sergeants and lieutenants received 10% raises and will receive a 5% increase because of the common ground reached. The commissioners approved the raises by unanimous vote. The issue of the sheriff's office raised problems with some department heads inside county government. Even after the vote, the juvenile detention and probation chief, Forrest Hanna, followed Kreiner's wanting 15% increases for his jailers and 5% increases for juvenile jail supervisors and probation officers, raises that were not part of Johnson's proposed budget. Johnson even told Hanna on Friday that his situation and the situation with the sheriff were apples and oranges, specifically because of the inmate-to-county official ratios. Judge Kyle Peeler reminded commissioners later that juvenile crimes in Midland recently included four murders and 15 felony-grade sexual assaults. "I don't think people understand what juvenile supervisor officers do," Peeler said. "When we say public safety, we're keeping them in detention because I am uncomfortable releasing them." Raises for juvenile jail supervisors and probation officers will be voted on at a future meeting. While there was some relief about compromise and all county officials later said raises happened department-wide, Johnson expressed his regret that the sheriff's office employees did not receive the raises in the proposed budget. He said during the meeting the other commissioners had allowed unprecedented spending on roads in previous budgets and thanked them for that, and he had hoped to make a similar effort with the sheriff's office. Kreiner said during the meeting he was a combined 36 employees short when it came to jailers and patrolmen. He and Johnson wanted salary closer to what Midland Police Department officers make. Other commissioners expressed their doubt that salary increases would make much of a difference in the number of vacancies, pointing to the vacancies that existed at MPD. Also, the double-digit percentage increases in salary in Johnson's budget were different from what other departments received. The rank and file of the county's civilian workforce are set to receive stipends of 3, 4, or 5%, depending upon how much money they currently make. 3% for those making $100,000, 4% for those making up to between 50 and 100, and 5% for those making less than $50,000. That included those in warrant services and emergency management. "What is fair," Johnson said. "This is paying the sheriff's department what they deserve." Decades of Design During Uncertain Times by Ben Schaefer. Rotenberry Wellen Architects, the architecture firm responsible for design of the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center and many other well-known Midland structures, has been able to find great success in the uncertain architectural landscape. The firm's success is a credit to the Rotenberry Wellen's client base in Midland, West Texas, and beyond for allowing them to do great work, according to owner Mike Wellen. Wellen came to Midland in 1977 to work with revered Texas architect, the late Frank Welch. He then met Jim Rotenberry, who was working with Welch at the time. Welland stayed with Welch until 1983 while Rottenberry attended graduate school and started his own practice with fellow Welch alum Andrew Hempfield until 1986 oil crash when Hempfield left the firm. Welland and Rottenberry had separate companies for 2 or 3 years until they merged in 1988, forming Rottenberry Welland Architects. When Jim and I first got together, we did the seed building out at UTPB campus. We did that 30 years ago, and then after that, we did the Commemorative Air Force Project. Those are some of the early big ones, Welland said. Today, Rottenberry Welland takes on a vast range of different projects. We do institutional work, commercial, residential, everything. Some of the firm's projects include the Chaparral Gallery, the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center, the I-20 Wildlife Preserve, the ConocoPhillips office buildings, and Rottenberry Welland is currently working on the Museum of the Southwest. The firm's extensive resume also includes residential homes, daycare centers, schools, and ranches throughout Midland and out of the state. We've been involved, I think, I counted the other day, in over 40 residential projects in Midland, either new houses or significant renovations and additions, and then we've worked various ranch projects for clients throughout the state of Texas and in Colorado, New Mexico, Maine, and California, Andy Chandler remarked. Clients can desire anything from a simple home addition to a new performing arts center or high-rise office building, which require different modes of thought. When you're general practitioners like we are, you have to be able to jump back and forth between that quite a bit. Since we don't really specialize in one type of building, it's a challenge sometimes, but we can thrive in that. No two projects are the same, Cale Lancaster added. Welland claimed that they have intentionally avoided restricting themselves as a firm so that they're able to work on different kinds of structures. That's because we don't want to be put in one corner, but also living in a smaller town like Midland, not a great big city, we're almost required to be general practitioners, and we're interested in all kinds of work. From year to year, the number of projects the firm undertakes can differ greatly, but Rottenberry Welland stays busy. It really depends, I think, this year we're at 40 or 50. It's a cyclical thing. Some years, Rottenberry Welland has fewer larger projects and lots of smaller ones. Other years, the firm may not have many projects, but those projects may be larger in scale. Like Cale said, there may be 40 projects on the book for this year, but a quarter of those may last 3 years in the process. We're allowed to spread our wings a little more in Midland, and I think a lot of that is due to the oil industry. They're pioneers in their field out here, so when they contact other professionals to help them, I think they kind of let us spread our wings a little more. We're allowed to do projects that wouldn't come to fruition in other places. Chandler commented on how West Texas' outstretched skies and desert landscape has inspired the firm's design. We really pride ourselves and enjoy and are purposefully in West Texas because of the advantages that it has. It's a wide open expanse of space ranging from Midland to El Paso, down to the Trans-Pecos and Big Bend area, and up to Lubbock. That's our base. Welland detailed the correlation between the oil and construction industries that can sometimes be challenging. The cycles of the oil industry impact the construction industry. The crash that happened in the 80s was a horrible crash, worse than anything we've experienced in the last few years, and that really slows down the construction industry. In the booms, especially the ones that last 10 to 15 years, the workforce is kind of sucked out of the construction industry and going into the oil industry. Welland said Midland's diverse and at times wealthy client base wants beautiful structures and an attractive city, which has allowed Rottenberry Welland to do what they do best and make their mark on Midland as a high-quality design firm. According to Principal T.J. McClure, their most recent work is in downtown Midland. Andy and John did the convention center and park downtown, but it takes a while to do some of these projects, so recent is a relative term. Lancaster shared details about the project that he's currently developing, a large commercial office development on Mockingbird and Midkiff, the Summit Center project that's a pretty big project. It's got a four-acre park in the center of it, a lot of great space. It's retail and office space. Other Rottenberry Wellen projects currently under construction are Christ Church, Domestic Abuse Treatment Center, Safe Place of the Permian Basin in Odessa. We always have residential projects being designed, under construction, or finishing up. The goal is to have good work. Hopefully the buildings are here long after we're gone, make an impact. The process of getting a structure built can vary drastically from project to project, but there are similarities that each one shares. They're all similar in that you have to start someplace with someone having an idea, something they want to do, but then you have to go through the process of programming what it is, which means laying out all the requirements of the project. They sometimes last 3 to 5 years to complete. Programming in and of itself can take months or even a whole year. According to Wellen, there aren't many certainties throughout the creation process. Programming can be done formally or informally. Communication with a client during the design and building process can be frequent or minimal. All these factors depend on the project and client. As the designs are finalized, we move into construction drawings and then the construction part of it. We've got a pretty extensive list of design awards. That doesn't just speak to us, that speaks to our clients as well. I'm quietly shocked at how well we do in the design world as a whole, kind of benchmarking ourselves against our colleagues outside the Permian Basin. Rottenberry Wellen has secured 52 design and architecture awards thus far. The list includes American Institute of Architects National Awards and West Texas Chapter American Institute of Architects Awards. T.J. McClure designed Midland's El Granero Polo Barn in 2021 that won the Architizer A-Plus Award, a global architecture prize. Texas-sized garage sale means so much for the Stovalls. By Iris Foster. Midland banker Bill Stovall can get it done, whatever it happens to be. He and his wife, Monty, are this year's honorary chairs for the Texas-sized garage sale beginning October 7th. It's a fitting tribute for someone who has supported senior services since the 70s and his steadfast high school sweetheart. The fundraiser benefits Meals on Wheels and other programs at Senior Life Midland, and the deadline for donations is September 1st. The early bird opening on October 7th has a $5 admission fee, and the other dates, October 8th, 11th, and 13th, have free admission. Bill was a charter member of the Board of Senior Life Midland's nascent organization, Community and Senior Services. For one of that agency's programs, he used his banking connections to get local merchants to offer discounts on gold cards for senior citizens. He was a board president when Fred Furman's home at Sinclair in Midland was donated for CSS headquarters in the 1980s. Until this year, it has continued to serve the organization and will be the site of its expanded new home. Stovall tells the story that the fledgling nonprofit was using donated downtown office space prior to the gift. As a banker, he was most concerned that utility costs and upkeep of the grounds would drastically affect the budget. So along with his board and the executive director at the time, Bill suggested to the city that CSS operate the two existing citizens' seniors. With that plan in place, they asked the Parks Department to handle lawn maintenance for the new headquarters. CSS originally operated a handyman service, the gold cards, and added share a meal offerings on weekends to Meals on Wheels recipients. The meals were purchased from Midland Memorial Hospital and delivered by volunteers in organizations like the JCs. A separate organization handled weekday meals, but it eventually merged with Community and Senior Services, and the Furman Garage was retrofitted as a commercial kitchen. In 2022, 500 meals are prepared 5 days per week for local folks. Over the years, Bill and Monty have donated to the garage sale. When one of his sons was returning home in a Ryder truck after college graduation, Bill arranged for CSS truck to meet him in front of his house. They backed the Ryder truck up to the other one, offloaded it, and nothing touched the ground. He says Monty is replacing living room furniture in time to donate the existing pieces to this year's sale. just as he watched his banking career twist and turn with the economy, the oil business, and bank failures and mergers, he's seen this popular fundraiser grow. It is now housed in a 25,000-square-foot colorful warehouse complex at 407 East Scarborough, just east of Big Spring Street, donated by Lloyd Inerarity. Garage sale donations are accepted there from 8 to noon on Mondays and Wednesdays through September 1st. Once a conglomeration of stuff, the location is divided into departments for ease of shipping, for ease of shopping, thanks to volunteers who worked for months to organize everything. Bill finally finished his board service at Community and Senior Services. After serving 8 years as a Midland Junior Baseball Commissioner, long after his two sons had aged out, Bill had to beg off getting it done for that group. When Lee High School needed a baseball game announcer, Coach Jesse Benavidez turned to Bill, who became the voice of the Rebels. There are other projects the Bill has helped get done, including passage of the bond for the sports complex. In fact, about the only time he didn't succeed when he was co-chaired was when he co-chaired the school bond election with the late Joan Baskin. He still bristles about that loss. Looking out the window at his 12th floor corner office at Community National Bank, where he is CEO and has worked for 26 years, he comments that he started his banking career at age 22 in the red brick building that Community National Bank moved from in 2020. Long ago, it was the home of Midland National Bank. He cycled through the First City and Northwest banks before landing at CNB. Although he and his wife are Midland High alumni, both of his sons graduated from Lee, and his grandchildren attend Midland Christian School. No doubt someone somewhere in Midland is about to ask him to chair a project and get it done. Explore Frida Kahlo exhibit at Museum of the Southwest by Morgan Thomas. Hidden in the bathroom of the Blue House for 50 years, more than 6,000 photographs, drawings, letters, medicines, and clothing surfaced in 2003, providing the public new insight into Frida Kahlo's tempestuous life. The house, donated after her 1954 passing by her husband Diego Rivera, now stands as a museum dedicated to the iconic artist's work located in Mexico City. Traveling internationally since the first showing in 2009, Frida Kahlo, her photos, have hit 20 different cities. Now the collection of 241 selected unpublished photos have entered the Lone Star State for the first time, settling into the walls of the Museum of the Southwest from August 26th through November 20th. I think when you go through the exhibition, you understand Frida in a different way, Perla Labarth, general coordinator of the museum in Mexico City, told the Reporter Telegram. We're familiar with her story and her artworks, but we're not familiar with the idea that photography was very important to her. We can see some of the photographs she used as references to paint. Divided into six dramatic, thematic sections, Frida Kahlo, her photos, takes viewers on a journey through some of the most influential moments of the famous Latin American painter's life. Sections include the origins, about her early life and family, the Blue House, politics, revolutions, and Diego, featuring Moscow, 1928. Her broken body, depicting the severe accident she suffered at just 18 years old. Frida's loves, an intimate collection of the people Kahlo held dear to her heart, and photography. Together, the six sections and their respective photos show Kahlo in moments of both strength and weakness, highlighting what she valued, what provided her with inspiration, her heritage, and the impact photography had on her and her family. Perhaps no other artist has had the impact on a generation of people throughout the 20th and 21st century as Frida did. Her work is intimate, powerful, honest, and she allows us in. I think that's what's so special. Other famous photographer features in the collection include Man Ray, Martin Mancasi, Edward Weston, Bressai, Tina Madotti, Pierre Verger, and Lola and Manuel Alvarez Bravo. Other photos include personal keepsakes and family heirlooms. Teen court attempts to stop illegal behavior at Origin. by Ben Schaefer. Midland Teen Court was founded in 1986 as a collaboration between the City of Midland and the Junior League of Midland. Its mission, according to Executive Director Chalice Phillips, is to use alternative discipline methods to impede Midland teens' pattern of poor choices, reducing the likelihood of further offenses while also promoting accountability and community. Teen Court isn't solely focused on reprimanding illegal behavior. They want to turn young people who have made poor choices into productive members of their community. Phillips said the number of teens directed to Midland Teen Court varies, but they typically see 300 to 400 youths a year. I'd say we're pretty successful. We kind of measure recidivism and how often they're coming back, Phillips said. It's not often. About 80% of our teens do not come back. Teen offenders are ordered by a Midland County judge to attend teen court instead of traditional forms of criminal punishment. When they come to our program, they're required to do community service, to give back and make up their fines, Phillips said. The juries decide on the amount of community service and the number of jury duties they have to do. In addition to community service, teens are required to serve on juries themselves. Also, Teen Court works with community organizations to conduct services like anger management classes and counseling. When they commit a crime, when they've made an offense, there's usually an underlying reason. It's not just bad choices. There's usually something going on. There are also monthly educational seminars available for young people on Teen Court. This furthers the court's mission of turning young offenders into dynamic members. The court partners with federal organizations to bring in human trafficking awareness specialists, speakers who share statistics and information on prescription drug abuse and driving while intoxicated. They also brought in speakers from Midland Mental Health Clinic, Rays of Hope, to speak about grief and coping skills. Different community organizations teach these kids about how to be safe and make good choices. Midland Teen Court takes on youth with any offense from minor traffic violations to assault, disorderly conduct, destruction of property, theft, or drug and alcohol offenses. This teaches our teens to become productive citizens. It's not just, let's throw them in jail. It's accountability for their actions. They don't just get off. They have to do some work and kind of make up for what they've done. The founding and near 40-year history of this program shows that Midland cares about the future of area teens, according to Phillips. Instead of just entering the system, we're trying to keep them out of it. Phillips remarked that the Teen Court is impacting lives in a great way by stopping illegal behavior at its origin. Possible supply cuts boost oil prices 2.5% by Mel McEwen. Crude prices posted a weekly gain, boosted by Saudi Arabia's warning earlier in the week that oil supply cuts may be necessary to balance a volatile market. West Texas Intermediate rose 3 to 5 trading days, with Tuesday's 338 climb and Wednesday's $1.15 gain overcoming Thursday's 237 drop. Prices gained 54 cents on Friday to end the week at 93.06, a 2.5% gain from last Friday's close. The posted price ended at 89.54. I think we're seeing the impact of a historic SPR release, Matt Gallagher, president of Green Lake Energy, said. Crude prices were wobbling between concerns about supplies and economic downturns. It's masking how tight physical inventories are. Travis Thompson, chief CEO of Firebird Energy, commented, "Although we continue to monitor commodity prices, we are currently committed to our activity level. We have 3 rigs committed to our position and plan to execute at that level through the end of the year." Natural gas prices rose 3 of 5 trading days, starting with a 34% jump Monday, but plunging almost 48 cents Tuesday, and a 4.5 cent gain couldn't overcome. Natural gas on the New York MEX dropped 8 cents Friday to close at 9.296 per MCF, down from 9.336 last Friday. When you look at prices, you look at 2 things, market fundamentals and external factors, Juan Alvarado said. He said market fundamentals do not support current price levels. Demand has come down and supplies are robust, with liquefied natural gas exports stable at 11 billion cubic feet throughout the summer. Storage levels have been low, but this week saw the highest level of injection seen all season at 44 BCF. "We're not looking at prices reacting to supply and demand," he said, "so we look at external factors. Investors are looking at something beyond supply and demand. The big factor is Russia shutting down the Nord Stream pipeline for 3 days and then restoring supplies at 20%, which isn't much, and it may not get back to 20%. That has sent European prices surging to $80 per MCF. A lot of what's happening in the market is not knowing what to make of that. The direction of gas prices will depend on weather. If winter is mild, prices will fall. But if there are winter storms similar to Winter Storm Uri, which ravaged Texas 2 years ago, prices could rise even higher than current levels. Traditionally, Alvarado continued, oil and natural gas prices were linked, as natural gas was traditionally associated with crude oil production. That is, until hydraulic fracturing came along and production of the two fuels wasn't as closely linked. Northeastern natural gas production isn't tied to crude oil. Then there's the transition from using coal for electric generating plants to using natural gas, which has put new upward pressure on natural gas. Now demand for gas is up, and it's not tied to crude production. There's been a decoupling in the market between the two, he said. Rig count snaps losing streak, adds 3 rigs, by Mel McEwen. Drilling activity rose the final week of August as the rig count snapped a 3-week decline. The rig count also posted its first monthly loss, snapping a record 24-month winning streak. Oilfield Services' Baker Hughes said its weekly rig count, which has released since the 1940s, rose 3 rigs to 765 nationwide. That's 2 rigs below the 767 reported at the end of July, but 257, or 51% more than the 508 counted last August. The number of rigs drilling for crude oil rose 4 to 605. The number of rigs drilling for natural gas dipped by 1 to 158. Texas added 2 rigs for 371 at work statewide. New Mexico was unchanged at 106. Louisiana joined Texas as the only producing state to see an increase. No other producing state saw changes during the week. The Permian Basin added 3 rigs for 348. Lee County, New Mexico, remains the most active in the Permian with 64 rigs, up 3 for the week. Eddy County is second with 39 rigs, down 3. Midland and Martin County each reported 34 rigs for the week, up 3 for Martin and up 2 for Midland. Reeves County gained 2 for 32, followed by Loving with 26 rigs for a second week. Upton County had 21 rigs, down 1 for the week. Ward County had 15, and Glasscock County reported 10. Winkler County had no drilling activity this week. Enverus Foundations, part of the energy-focused software as a service firm Enverus, said there were as many as 852 rigs drilling in the U.S. during the week ending August 24th. That count was up 1% from a month earlier. Major plays with weekly increases were the DJ Basin up by 2 and the Anadarko Basin up by 1. The Anadarko hit a 2022 high and its highest activity level in nearly 3 years. The most active operators were Continental Resources, Citizens Energy, and Mewbourne Oil. The rig count fell by 2 in the Williston Basin during the last week, and the Permian count fell by 1 to 322. Activity was flat week over week in the Gulf Coast at 113 rigs. Diamondback Energy and Rattler Midstream complete merger. Merger resulted in Diamondback acquiring all of the limited partner interests in Rattler not already owned by Diamondback and its subsidiaries. Each public unit holder of Rattler received 0.113 of a share of common stock in Diamondback in exchange for each Rattler common unit owned. Effective August 24th, Rattler's common units will no longer be listed on the NASDAQ Global Select Market, and it will cease to be a publicly traded company. Alfred Joseph Boudreau passed away on Tuesday, August 23rd. A memorial service will be held Tuesday, August 30th at 1 p.m. at St. Anne's Catholic Church. Services are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home. Betty Marie Lochler passed away on Friday, August 19th. Her wishes were to be cremated and to be laid to rest between her husband and son with no formal service. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home. Ida Mae Kemper passed away on August 20th. A celebration of life will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, August 27th, at Willowbrook Funeral Home. Services are entrusted to Willowbrook and cremation Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Midland. Olin Curtis Smith passed away on August 20th. A public visitation will be held on Friday, August 26th from 1 to 5 p.m. at Ellis Rest Haven Funeral Home. Memorial service will be held Saturday, August 27th at 2:30 p.m. at the funeral home. Funeral services are under the direction of Ellis Rest Haven Funeral Home. Pamela Ruth Hedrick passed away on August 24th. A visitation will be from 2 to 4 p.m. on Sunday, August 28th at Gilbreth Funeral Home. Services will be held at 10 a.m. on Monday, August 29th at First Baptist Church in Stanton. Interment will follow at Evergreen Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Gilbert Funeral Home of Stanton. Sonia K. Crump Roden passed away on July the 4th. The family will receive friends on Friday, August 19th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Crowder Funeral Home in Leake City. A funeral mass will be Friday, August 26th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Clair of Assisi Catholic Church in Houston. Services in Midland will be September 2nd at 11 a.m. at First Presbyterian Church in Midland. Her body will be interred at Chalk Mountain Cemetery, Somerville County, Texas, at a later date. Susan R. Richardson passed away. The family will receive guests from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday, August 28th at Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home. Celebration of life will be held at 2 p.m. Tuesday, August 30th at First Presbyterian Church in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home. Jesus Gabriel Bejarano passed away on August 24th. Rosary will be recited at 7 p.m. Sunday, August 28th at Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home. Mass will be held at 11:30 a.m. Monday at St. Anne's Catholic Church with internment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home.
This is Jane reading for the OA for Saturday, August 27th. Darkness can never outshine the light. Bright Stars Memorial is Wednesday in Odessa. As the third anniversary of the August 31st, 2019 mass shooting tragedy nears, Odessans are embracing the day as one to come together to honor those who lost their lives and those who were injured both physically and emotionally. Wednesday's Sunrise Memorial will be about reflection and community service and gathering to support one another. It will be about light. Seven people died that dark day, and more than two dozen others were injured. The trauma that rampage of a deranged gunman left in this community cannot be denied, but it can't keep this community in darkness. Instead, the community is invited to gather Wednesday near what will be the site of a memorial to those victims and this community. The landmark will be stunning when finished in August of 2023 on the UTPB campus. It will be a place of peace, reflection, and light. That light is what is important to Odessa and Kelby Davis. Light and celebrating the community that rallied around her family and the families of others. 3 years ago, when the darkness came, Kelby's husband, Garrett, and her young family are forever linked to that day in Odessa. Their daughter, Anderson, was the youngest victim of the shooting rampage. The toddler was taken to Medical Center Hospital and then transferred to University Medical Center in Lubbock. Anderson underwent multiple surgeries. She first had shrapnel removed from her chest, mouth, and tongue, and later she had surgery to remove teeth knocked out by a bullet. Anderson, along with her twin brother Rhett, are now thriving four-year-olds who finished up summer soccer and are on to flag football this fall. Kelby Davis said this week the entire family will join other Odessans at 7 a.m. on Wednesday near the site of the planned memorial. They will wear yellow and are encouraging others to do so as well to add more brightness to the day. I'm really grateful that the community has come together to remember and honor all that that day really stands for, in the sense of coming together and honoring the lives lost and just shining the light, she said. The Davis family will add a baby boy to their family in October. She said the support of the community has meant everything to their growing family and to Anderson as she recovered. Wednesday's event is billed as a time to honor those losses and by doing good in the community. I encourage everyone to join us as a community. We have never chosen to let that day define us, and the community has done a beautiful job of shining light. We want to start the day and spread lightness as a reminder that darkness can never outshine the light. Davis said plans for the memorial Wednesday include encouraging Odessans to perform random acts of kindness or community service. Just smile at people or buy someone coffee and just wear yellow and help us carry on the memory of the lives lost and also honor how amazing this community is. State Representative Brooks Landgraf plans to attend Wednesday with his family.
Hello, this is Michael reading an additional article from the Odessa American from Saturday, August 27th, 2022. Front page. Top Cops, Law Enforcement Now Better Equipped by Kim Smith. As the three-year anniversary of Odessa's mass shooting approaches, Ector County's top cops firmly believe law enforcement is better equipped to handle the threat if the unspeakable should happen again. On August 31, 2019, Seth Aaron Ator, 36, went on a shooting spree that ended in his death outside Odessa's Synergy Theater. Before it was over, he took the lives of seven people and hurt 25 others, including three law enforcement officers. Ator was unique in that he was a mobile mass shooter. There were 24 shooting scenes, 11 on Interstate 20, and the remaining on the streets of Midland County and Odessa. An Uber driver in Kalamazoo, Michigan, killed six and wounded two at three locations in February 2016. Dozens of law enforcement officers from local, state, and federal agencies responded the day Ador erupted, apparently upset at having been fired from his oil field job. Odessa Police Chief Mike Gerke and Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths agreed their agencies are better equipped when it comes to strategy, equipment, and communications. They're also seeing an increase in the number of calls they receive from citizens raising red flags. New strategies. In the years since the mass shooting at Columbine High School in Colorado in 1999, law enforcement officers have spent countless hours preparing for active shooter events. But Gerke said that training is geared toward eliminating the threat of a fixed suspect. That wasn't the situation they encountered 3 years ago. One of the things that happened is we chased this guy around, and then we realized that that wasn't working. So we had to disperse our forces and look for him individually. You would hear you had victims at this location, and officers would go to that location, and on the way, try to look for your shoot actor, and obviously, he was already gone by the time we got there, and that was part of the problem. There was no way to track him effectively. Ultimately, law enforcement decided to disperse and look for Ator individually. Officers looked for Ator roughly 50 minutes before finding him. From the time we actually laid eyes on him until the threat was neutralized, it's like 42 seconds. So it wasn't a problem of officers not choosing to act. It was a problem of finding him because he was mobile, because he was in a vehicle. And then midway through the incident, he changed vehicles, Gerke said. Should something similar happen again, Gerke said supervisors now understand how they must deploy their force, the chief said. You would assign people to certain geographical areas and say, this is your geographical area. This is where you need to hunt, because that's what it is, he said. When hunts are launched, the department now has a camera system that will greatly aid them in tracking suspects, Gerke said. The department has 16 incident management cameras mounted at various locations around town and monitored at the city's real-time intelligence center. In addition, the city of Odessa and Ector County both have several flock safety cameras strategically placed throughout the area that can read license plates. Both also have drones. As far as the sheriff's office, Griffiths said his deputies now have take-home vehicles that will allow them to jump into action more quickly. That day, he had deputies responding to various shooting scenes in their privately owned vehicles, which could have been dangerous if other officers on the scene didn't recognize them, he said. We got more people on our SWAT team. We've got better weapons, better weaponry, more training. You know, we can deploy at a moment's notice, Griffiths said. Every deputy has now been issued the same caliber handgun so they can share ammunition if necessary. Everybody also has a tactical rifle and shotgun now, he said. Additional deputies have been sent to special pursuit driving training, too, Griffiths said. Pursuit driving is a unique skill because when you're driving 100 miles an hour and slowing down and stopping, your brakes get so hot that they don't work. They're useless. I've actually seen them catch on fire. They've been so hot. They get red hot, Griffiths said. You have to learn how to properly keep the bad guy's car in sight, and yet you have to keep your eye on the public, the innocent public. You have to know how to take care of yourself and your car, and that includes the way you're braking, the way you're accelerating, and the way you're turning. The sheriff's office also expects to receive a new armored truck in the next 6 to 8 months that will replace the agency's mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, which is out of service right now, Griffiths said. The vehicle was purchased with donated and seized funds, he said. The ability of law enforcement agencies to communicate with each other over the radio has also improved, Gerke and Griffiths said. At the time of the shooting, the Midland Police Department only had the ability of speaking with law enforcement agencies in Ector County on one channel. Now there are three channels, Gerke said. The Midland County Sheriff's Office is also abandoning an old radio system that was incompatible with the system used by everyone else, Chief said. Communications were an issue 3 years ago, but things have improved, Griffiths said. It wasn't that good. I mean, there were some channels everyone could communicate on, but only one person could speak on the radio at a time, really and truly, Griffiths said. This system will override the current person who's talking, so if someone's in a bind, someone will hear them. It's a better deal. External communications have also improved since the Ador situation, the men agreed. State legislators overwhelmingly approved a bill proposed by State Representative Brooks Landgraf, Republican Odessa, to create a statewide active shooter alert system that operates similarly to the Amber Alert system for kidnapped children. In addition, residents can sign up for OPD's app, which sends out alerts about shootings, major crashes, and other incidents where there's a large police presence. They can also sign up for Civic Ready, which sends out emergency alerts via texts and emails, along with notices about the weather, downtown Odessa, and Keep Odessa Beautiful. Gerke said he's also pleased that people have taken heed of the See Something, Say Something movement. OPD has seen an uptick in phone calls for people reporting suspicious behavior, and while it's impossible to say how many bad things have been avoided as a result, he's sure there have been some. More residents are also taking advantage of Civilian Response to Active Shooter Events, CRASE, C-R-A-S-E, and Stop the Bleed courses, he said. The police chief also said his department has provided the FBI all of the case information and videos pertaining to the shooting in the event the agency's Behavioral Analysis Unit wants to study ATOR and his actions.
This is Jane reading for the Odessa American for Saturday, August 27th, boil water notice lifted. The boil water notice imposed late Wednesday night for 20,000 to 25,000 North Odessans was lifted around 9 a.m. on Friday. On Wednesday night, a glitch in a computer system responsible for evaluating water levels and water pressure occurred, forcing the City of Odessa to impose the notice. Odessa Public Works Director Tom Kerr said that a system called Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition is responsible for measuring various data points at the city's elevated tanks and pump stations and transmitting the information back to the city's main water plant on 42nd Street. On Wednesday night, increased usage caused water levels to drop, but because of the glitch, operators were unaware of it and did not increase the pumpage to address the routine drop. Complaint calls told us something was amiss, so we began to evaluate the system. The calls began around 9 p.m., and the issue was rectified by 10 p.m., but because the water pressure had dropped below 20 pound force per square inch, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality required the city to impose a boil water notice. It's unclear why the SCADA system failed, but upgrades are scheduled to take place as part of the city's water plant upgrade project, Kerr said. This is Jane reading for the OA for Saturday, August 27th. Student with gun prompts PHS lockdown. A call went out at 3:30 on Friday that there was a man with a gun attempting to get into Permian High School. An Odessa Police Department release detailed that this caused a large police presence at the school by various law enforcement agencies. A juvenile male was detained and found to be in possession of a firearm, and there are no reported injuries or damage at this time. According to a message sent to parents, law enforcement was releasing students room by room. It asked parents to be patient, as your student's safety is our top priority. Amber Tony was waiting for one of her children outside Permian. Tony said her daughter messaged her and said she was terrified because there was someone in the school with a gun. She has two children at Permian. Tony headed to Permian, and by that time, she was also freaking out. After the shooting at the elementary school in Uvalde, I was freaking out. I'm still holding back tears, Tony said. Evitel Salinas said her niece called her and told her there was a large police presence at Permian. Her granddaughter goes to PHS. Salinas said she was in a panic and she told what was going on. I'm nervous because something happened every day in schools, Salinas said. She said she thinks the schools need metal detectors and that the mesh and clear backpacks at secondary schools don't work. Salinas added that student records need to be shared, such as if a student had a problem at middle school. On Thursday, a student at Odessa High was stabbed during a fight. This is Jane reading for the OA for Saturday, August 27th. Man accused of two counts of aggravated assault. An Odessa man was arrested Tuesday after two people said he pointed a gun at them during an argument. According to an Ector County Sheriff's Office report, deputies received a call about a disturbance in the 400 block of North Nancy Avenue. And when they arrived, a 54-year-old woman and a 48-year-old man told them they'd gone to the home to pick up some belongings and got into an altercation with Braylon Bryant, 23. During the altercation, the couple said Bryant pulled a gun from his pocket and pointed it at them. According to the report, deputies found a 9mm Ruger in Bryant's possession. Bryant was arrested on suspicion of two counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a Class 2 felony punishable by a prison sentence of 2 to 20 years. Bryant was released from the Ector County Jail after posting surety bonds totaling $70,000.
Hello, friends. This is Julie reading from the Odessa American, Sunday, August 28th. PSP leader says workforce is key. Bentley calls for more sophisticated approach by Ruth Campbell. Permian Strategic Partnership President and CEO Tracy Bentley is idealistic about the energy industry and what it can do to brighten the region's future. Saying her job lets her focus her knowledge and skills in a variety of directions, Bentley adds that her relatively new coalition of 17 companies aims has an ambitious strategy of promoting advancements in education, healthcare, transportation, affordable housing, and especially workforce. Now that we have 3.5 years under our belt and we've got initiatives to show the projects we've been working on, I think interest has definitely grown, Bentley said, adding that membership rosters will probably lengthen. When it comes to education, our assignments and research shows that our area has a wonderful opportunity to expand and really benefit from the career and technical education, she said. In the next year or two, she said, PSP will make even more specific investments in CTE and workforce readiness, having already given $109 million in investments, which have been leveraged into $950 million in collaborative investments. PSP has funded healthcare initiatives, road safety equipment, National Board for Professional Teaching Standards, certification for teachers, and education for the future. Healthcare Providers has helped small towns with grant opportunities, among other initiatives. But we believe that partners, the largest challenge for us as an industry working in Permian, is going to be human capital, Bentley said. We're trying hard to do everything we can to identify how we can get ahead of that and aggressively recruit and retrain our future workforce, Bentley said. We think career and technical education is one of the routes that's going to get us there, so exciting things are coming in CTE. She said the industry not only needs people in the field, but also accounts human resources and computer services professions, chemists and engineers, and communications and media professionals. People are shocked to hear that, so we need to do a better job of telling them all the options there are to work in the oil and gas industry, Bentley said. If they don't know that, we can't expect them to go researching for us. We need to be actively recruiting them. The group's operation area in West Texas and southeastern New Mexico. Born and raised in Colorado, Bentley spent much of her life there except for a couple years in Washington, D.C., right before this job, I was running the Colorado Petroleum Council, and many members of PSP were involved in that organization as well, she said. They had started telling me about this effort underway in the Permian Basin to form an organization that worked on making the Permian an even better place to live and raise a family, Bentley said. I said, that is so unique. I've never heard of anything like it. And that response was, nothing like it exists to our knowledge. This will be the first of its kind. And I said, well, that is so neat. I can't wait to watch it grow and see all the things that we're going to do. And one of them said, well, interesting enough, they're looking for a president CEO. Is there any way you would consider moving from Colorado to West Texas? So we flew down for a weekend, drove around the area, and stayed for a couple of nights. We left saying we definitely could see ourselves here. So I went back and officially applied, and here I am. Prior to running the Colorado Petroleum Council, Bentley worked for Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper from 2011 to 2015. He was a big supporter and a big promoter, actually, of public-private partnerships, she said. Working for him, I was involved in one degree or another to get large projects done that maybe there wasn't the budget for. I was able to take that experience and knowledge of how government works at all levels, running an organization and working with industry, and package it all in one, Bentley said. She also worked with the Colorado Farm Bureau on national affairs, including oil and gas, as well as some renewable energy. I've had touch points with the industry throughout most of my adult career, Bentley said. Before moving to West Texas, she lived in northern Colorado between Fort Collins and Greeley in Severance, right in the middle of the Denver-Julesburg oil basin. I think that lends itself to why this place felt like home for us, too, Bentley said. She added that one of the things she and her husband Michael love about living here is the climate. They have 3 children, 2 daughters and a son. We acclimated very quickly to the most year-round warm temperatures, Bentley said. My husband would tell you he likes it because he can golf almost all year round, Bentley said. Having earned a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in communications from Colorado State University, she said, there was a time when I wanted to be in sports broadcasting. Then when I was to get my master's, I knew I wanted to apply those skills somehow in the public sector. I enjoy storytelling, and I do believe that's an art to that. It's something I really enjoy, so I think that's what led me to my major. Odessa Chamber of Commerce President, CEO, Renee Earls, said when they have worked with PSP, the staff has been very responsive to hearing about community needs and getting involved. The organizations have been active in trying to bring high-speed, affordable broadband to the basin and was very active in census efforts. They wanted to make sure the Permian Basin was represented. We've all had an undercount in this area. I think we did again, but PSP was there and vocal, Earl said. Some PSP communities are big Odessa community sponsors, but probably the majority are Midland. Earl says she thinks Odessa should be better represented in it. She added that PSP has done an incredible job in the region, particularly in New Mexico, and as an organization, they hit a home run bringing Bentley to the region. She has very strong connections and was really well-versed in the industry, Earl says. University of Texas Permian Basin President Sandra Woodley said she admires Bentley's dedication to the Permian Basin and enjoys her partnership on several important initiatives. She is such an effective and innovative leader who already has an impressive impact on our community, Woodland said in the email. The Permian Strategic Partnership mission is to strengthen and improve the quality of life for Permian Basin residents by partnering with federal, state, and local leaders to develop and implement strategic plans and foster superior schools, safer roads, quality health care, affordable housing, and a trained workforce, its website says. The companies involved with PSP will bring people, expertise, resources, and leadership to develop solutions in partnerships with local leaders and communities. Odessa couple arrested on suspicion of manufacturing. Staff writer. Expired tags led to the arrest Thursday of an Odessa couple on felony drug charges. According to an Odessa Police Department report, an official was patrolling an area known for drugs on East Highway 80 Thursday morning when he spotted a Ford Taurus with tags that had expired in August 2020 and no insurance. When the driver activated his lights to pull the driver over, he noticed a lot of furtive movements inside the car, and the driver hit the curb when she pulled over. The officer smelled marijuana coming from the car, and during a subsequent search of the vehicle, he found 23.9 grams of methamphetamine, sandwich baggies, a drug leaguer, and an unsealable amount of marijuana, according to the report. The driver of the car, McKaylee Dawn Jarrett, 34, and her passenger, Dustin Anthony Travis, 34, were taken to the Ector County Jail on suspicion of manufacturing, delivering of a controlled substance. A Class 1 felony in possession of marijuana, a Class B misdemeanor. According to the report, Jarrett was also arrested on suspicion of having a prohibited substance in a correctional facility, a Class 3 felony. After correlation officers watching her charge into jail scrubs discovered she'd been concealing 1.2 grams of methamphetamine and 6 pills of gabapentin, an anticonvulsant.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.